You're listening to Sunday Extra on RN. The world as we know is full of stories. So here is one that has so much suffering in it, so much punishment, it feels as though it comes from the pages of a lost book of the Old Testament. It has to do with Albert Woodfox, who is living witness to the collision in the American South of race politics and the criminal justice system. Albert Woodfox spent 43 years in solitary confinement in the Louisiana State Penitentiary, 43 years in solitary in the jail that is known notoriously as Angola Prison. That is longer than anyone else is known to have survived in solitary confinement, and it was for a murder that in the end even the law recognized he did not commit. He's a free man, but in his own way he became a free man while he was in solitary. But we'll get him to explain that to you himself. Albert Woodfox, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's get this out of the way first, Albert. You were a criminal kid. You stole, you did violence to others, and you don't pretend otherwise.
No. Well, you know, given the economic and racial policies in America during my teen years, it had been studied and it decided that one out of every four African-American men would wind up in prison. It was my unfortunate to be that one out of four.
And when you started in prison, one of the things you had to do was to survive, and you survived by being tough, by dealing with the rules of the game. And for the first few years in prison, you were that tough prisoner. That's fair as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, I guess you could say you're a victim or you're a victimizer. There is no in-between in prison.
And the transformation came about because you started to meet a group of people that were unlike anyone else in the prison system, indeed in the wider African-American community, and this was the Black Panther movement. What were they doing that was different?
You know, it's kind of hard to put in words. You know, I always say that when I was coming up, my mom fought so valiantly to try to protect me from criminal life, but the voice of the street was louder than my mom, and later on in life, the voice of the Black Panther Party was louder than the voice of the street. Panthers spoke about things that I had subconsciously felt, and they spoke in a voice that I had never heard before. I was impressed by it, and eventually, you know, I became a member of the Black Panther Party.
First of all, describe for me what it was like in Angola Prison, and also you were in prison in New York at a place called the Tombs. Levels of violence inside the prison, of rapes inside the prison, is a terrifying insight to what those places might be. You decided to take a stand against that. How did you do that?
Well, you know, Harmon Wallace and I, who the deceased member of the Angola Dream, we were both in the same area of the prison, and we had been actively involved in forming a Black Panther Party chapter in prison and organizing against corruption, institutional racism, brutality, murder. Angola had been designated at that time as the bloodiest prison in America, and almost every week someone was being stabbed or bludgeoned or even killed. And so, you know, being a Black Panther, you know, I felt that it was a duty and an obligation to organize and try to bring an end to this, to try to bring, you know, Angola was segregated at the time. So I felt, you know, that if prisoners came together and stopped seeing color and start seeing humanity, that we could have some kind of control, some sense of self-worth, and not allow ourselves to be exploited and treated the way prisoners were at that time, and still are, you know.
Now, while you were in prison, a prison guard was murdered, and it was plain that what the prison authorities wanted to do was to tag that murder onto the people that they saw were the troublemakers in prison, the militants, as they described it, the members of the Black Panthers. And that was the way in which you got accused of the murder of a guard in an entirely different part of the prison. That was really the start of your period in solitary, decades in solitary, wasn't it?
Yes, the officer name was Brent Miller. He was found in one of the living units of Pine. He had been stabbed 32 times. And in spite of overwhelming evidence that I was in a dining hall eating at the time, numerous eyewitnesses, in spite of physical evidence found at the scene of the crime that indicated someone else did this, the prison officials had decided that, you know, myself and Harmon Wallace and some other people had committed this crime. And they were determined to make us pay and be used as an example against other prisons. And as a result of that, it took me 44 years and 10 months to win my freedom.
And there is no question in your mind that that was because you were a member of the Black Panthers.
Oh, yeah. You know, I went from being a political victim to being a political prisoner. I mean, one of the infamous wardens down by the name of Burl Cain, he stated to the press that even if he knew that Harmon and I were innocent, he would not release us from solitary because he didn't want us running around his prison preaching that Pantherism. So there was no doubt, you know, if a person is being persecuted and held in solitary confinement for his political beliefs and his activities, and in my eyesight, that constitutes a political prison. It was going on then, and it's still going on around the world now.
What was it like, a daily life in solitary confinement? What were the conditions in which you were in?
Well, you're confined to a 9x6 cell. There are two metal bunks attached to the wall, a metal zinc toilet bowl combination attached to the back of the wall, and a mellow table and bench attached to a wall across from the bunk. Now, the cell is 9x6, 9 feet long, 6 feet wide, but the space is much smaller because you only have that narrow path from the back wall to the bars that you can walk. You know, it's not like you have a lot of room because the two bunks join out from the wall, and you're held in this cell for 23 hours out of a 24-hour period. You're only allowed out of that cell 1 hour a day.
When you had your murder conviction overturned, you were given a choice. One was to have a retrial, I guess. The other one was to take a plea for a lower charge. You knew you hadn't murdered this guy. There was no way you could have murdered that prison guard. You weren't anywhere near it. Why did you take a plea? What's a decision? Because we hear this a lot in the United States legal system. We don't have it to the same degree here in Australia. Why would you make an admission about a crime that you did not commit?
Well, it was one of the most difficult decisions I, you know, ever had to make. And in a lot of ways, I still regret it. But I had been locked up 44 years and 10 months. My daughter, you know, had grown from an infant child to an adult. I had three adult grandchildren I had never held, and four great-grandchildren I had never held. And the case, the state didn't have enough evidence to bring me to trial, but they wouldn't release me in spite. And by the way, my case was overturned four times, not just once, but four different times. And The reversal for granting me a new trial was upheld by the United States Supreme Court. And as a result, I was being tried in West Feliciana Parish, which is a parish that Angola is located in. The history of West Feliciana Parish is very racist. Our lawyers had some people to do a poll, and over half of the parish either work in Angola or was related to some work in Angola. You know, so the prospect of getting a fair trial looked very dim. And even so, you know, all my life I had taught men to stand, to fight what you believe in and stuff. So it was very difficult. It didn't just happen overnight. You know, my lawyers and I went back for months, you know, on what would be the best way to proceed. And in the end, it was a conversation I had with my brother, in which he said, you know, one day he was talking with my daughter, and she broke down crying, and he said, what's the matter? And she said, well, I don't have a daddy. And she said, well, you have a daddy. I think you would be very proud of the man your daddy has become, the things he has accomplished, even in prison. And she said, but yeah, what'd it feel like to hug him? What'd it feel like to see daddy and hear his voice respond? What'd it feel like to feel him, to do things with him? I never had that experience. And so that probably was the deciding factor to make me, you know, decide to take this plea deal. Now, the plea deal was called NOLA contender. I did not plead guilty to killing Officer Miller. I plead guilty to the fact that the state had enough evidence to bring me to trial. And that's just what it was. It was a plea for freedom, not a plea for guilt.
You went into jail initially in the tumult of the 60s, and then you went through decades in jail. The world you came out into has changed in all kinds of ways. How much has it changed in terms of justice for the black men and women of America?
Not very much. I mean, the best proof is we have a president who is openly said he's a white supremacist, or he believes in white supremacy. We still have economic and political and social policies that, affect African Americans and other minorities and poor people in this country. And so the fact that, one of the things I realized, and it was a shock to me, that when I was released from prison, and after maybe 3-4 weeks, I realized that nothing had changed, that the only change in America was technology. America had been technologically advanced, and that superficially or on the surface, the appearance had changed. But underneath that, all of the things that I knew and grew up in, all of the attitude and stuff, was still there, and it's still here now. So, it was quite a shock to me, I was gone almost 50 years. And of course, I was aware of the technology and the changes that technology brought about. But I was shocked to realize that the changes were superficial, that they only occurred on the top.
You're now an older man. You have your freedom. What is it that brings you today your sense of pleasure and of satisfaction?
Well, what brings me pleasure, of course, is my family. I've been reunited with my family, and I have, as I said, I have a daughter, I have 3 adult grandchildren, and I have 4 beautiful great-grandchildren. That gives me great pain, knowing that I have a family, knowing that I'm a phone call away, that's on the personal side. On the political side, what gives me pleasure is that in spite of everything that was done to destroy me, I became stronger. I used my prison cell that was meant to be a death chamber. I used it as a school, and I re-educated myself. I used it as a law clinic. I taught myself the law, both criminal and civil. I used it as a debate in which challenge myself to understand and analyze, what was going on in society at the time. And so, I think that, a lot of times I'm asked, people say, you're not angry, you're not bitter. And I'm saying, well, there is some anger. You can't not be angry when people take half of your life away from you. And you can't be, bitter when so much wrong has been done to you, so much physical wrong. And so, I choose, as I said, there was a time in my life when I decided that I would be the human being I wanted to be, that I would take control of my life, that I would determine who I am, and not let the powers of this country and prison shape my moral principles, my values, my code of conduct. And so that has served me well,
Well, yours is an extraordinary story. We're lucky you survived to tell it. Albert Woodfox, the author of Solitary, Unbroken by four decades in solitary confinement, my story of transformation and hope, an extraordinary piece of testimony about a life spent in Angola prison, or substantially in Angola prison. Albert Woodfox, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
What a story.